Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. In today's episode, we spoke with Alyssa Cooper, MD. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Cooper discussed recent advances that have reshaped the treatment paradigm for small cell lung cancer, particularly in the relapse setting. The conversation also explored real-world treatment sequencing and decision-making at the point of relapse. The importance of multidisciplinary coordination was another key theme. Additionally, she highlighted the essential role of oncology pharmacists, nursing teams, and structured patient education. Finally, she emphasized that improving coordination between community and academic centers is essential to ensuring timely access to innovative therapies and clinical trials. Over the past 2 to 3 years, what scientific or therapeutic advances in small cell lung cancer have most meaningfully changed how you manage patients in the community, and what has not changed despite the data?
I think arguably the biggest impact that has changed small cell lung cancer management has been the approval of the drug tarlatamab, which is a DLL3 targeting T cell engager. It was FDA approved in May 2024 and has been in regular use since then. And since the phase 3 trial presented at ASCO this past year in 2025 is now considered the global standard, second line standard of care for patients with small cell lung cancer. This drug has been incredibly promising in terms of its overall impact, response rate, and durable survival for patients, and has really become the thing that we lean on most. In addition, there's been several promising clinical trials without approved agents in this setting. And so these are also very exciting avenues for patients to explore. And so these have been really things that have markedly moved the field forward in the past couple of years that really did not exist before then. What hasn't really changed is the first line setting, where we still really rely on the backbone of platinum-based chemotherapy and immunotherapy. And that really has remained the standard without many biomarkers to change that. That is under investigation, under study in several clinical trials, both whether the first line standard should be changed and whether there might be underlying biological predilections for certain patients to be able to predict one avenue of treatment over another. But unfortunately, we still don't have a first line standard that is different from the one that has been in use for the past several years.
When you're deciding on treatment sequencing for small cell lung cancer, particularly at relapse, what clinical factors carry the most weight in your day-to-day practice, and how closely does that align with guideline-driven recommendations?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think for most patients, we really hope to get them to tarlatamab or a clinical trial in the second line setting. At relapse, we really hope to be able to offer patients sort of the most novel and promising therapies. Clinical trials are certainly a priority, and actually they are in the NCCN guidelines as a recommended step for care. The thing that can be challenging with enrolling onto clinical trials is sort of the necessary delay in terms of potential screening and eligibility procedures. Sometimes these trials require screening scans and biopsies potentially that may ultimately delay starting. So if you have a patient who has really sort of aggressive relapse or aggressive progression, they may not be able to wait even the couple of weeks necessary in order to get onto a clinical trial. Similarly, for tarlatamab, now I think many places in the country are really up and running in terms of their operations here, but there still is sort of a necessary delay in terms of, at this point in many institutions, and I know this is not true everywhere, but in many institutions, for requesting an admission or sort of arranging the logistical operations necessary to be giving that therapy in the quote-unquote monitored healthcare setting as per the FDA label right now. So while we do try to get almost every patient to either tarlatamab or a clinical trial, the reality is that some patients might not be able to wait. The other thing is, if somebody has really aggressive disease that is growing, you might want to rely on a cytotoxic therapy that you might think might be a little bit more reliable in terms of reducing some of that disease burden a little bit more quickly. So sometimes I see people in the setting reaching for example, lurbinectedin or relying on lurbinectedin, or even potentially you might need to rely on, for example, radiation if somebody has disease that's really threatening an organ, for example, with new SVC syndrome or something like that.
Now, to your point, clinical trials often assume patients can receive treatment on schedule with close monitoring, but community clinics face real operational constraints. What are the most common workflow or access barriers you encounter in delivering that care, and how do you adapt when the ideal plan isn't feasible?
Yeah, it's a really great point. And one of the things that has really sort of highlighted this issue has been the question of quote unquote repriming patients who have had a delay in their administration of tarlatamab or other T cell engager therapies. As most people know, that these agents are delivered in a step-up fashion in order to reduce toxicity such as CRS and ICANS. Mostly CRS is what we focus on, sort of the safety around delivering these therapies. And by giving the dose in a step-up fashion, this does mitigate the potential for CRS and for severe CRS. Now, when patients are receiving these therapies, once they've sort of gone through the step-up period and are receiving them in a regular fashion as standard outpatient therapies, we think that the risk of CRS is quite reduced, and we're not so worried about it, about giving the therapy in the outpatient setting anymore. But if a patient has a complication or an illness, perhaps they're hospitalized for pneumonia or for, something else has gone on that has caused an interruption in giving the therapy, there really becomes a question of what are we supposed to do in that scenario for giving that therapy again in a safe way. And so I think many institutions, not all, but I think many institutions have struggled with whether to rehospitalize these patients. Do they need to go back to the beginning in terms of the required observation at the beginning, where patients are required to be watched for, 8 hours, for example, after a dose? And that gives real operational constraints in terms of chair time, nursing personnel, really just a lot of man hours in general, and how many people are thinking about what the right thing is to do for this person. The other thing that's really important that we encounter for patients who are referred to, for example, academic tertiary care centers, is that many people don't live near these areas in general. So, for example, in Boston, we do see a lot of patients who live primarily in Maine or New Hampshire or Vermont, more rural areas, and many things can happen that can sort of interrupt their ability to get care, especially when they live a couple hours or more away from the center where they're receiving care. There may be issues with a caregiver, issues with transportation, issues with access in terms of resources. So all of those come up and are generally a bit more mitigated on a clinical trial, because a clinical trial sort of generally kind of selects out for the patients who are able to participate most fully in these complicated protocols. And when we're trying to deliver agents that have been studied in a clinical trial setting in a standard of care fashion, it really does expose some of those vulnerabilities in terms of how best to serve all patients.
And then we know that small cell lung cancer management often requires rapid coordination across specialties, including medical oncology, radiation oncology, pulmonology, and supportive care. So, in your experience, what does effective collaboration look like in a community setting, and where are the biggest breakdown points that affect outcomes?
It's such a good question, because I think a small cell lung cancer diagnosis should necessarily triage or trigger a sort of rapid protocol unfolding, if you will. So it might actually be beneficial for, the pathologist also to be involved. So once that small cell lung cancer is diagnosed on the pathology sample, even a PAGE system or, something where I think people are alerted quite quickly to sort of be able to come up with a multidisciplinary plan. I actually sort of just heard about a case that my colleague had, where a patient was thought to have non-small cell lung cancer with an early stage lesion and was planned for surgery, but the pathology surprisingly came back from the biopsy as small cell lung cancer. And that really rapidly changes, the coordination and the overall plan. So I think starting from the time that we know the diagnosis, I think it's imperative that all the specialties are sort of like in some sort of communication, whether that's email or, any sort of other secure chat platform that their hospital uses. But it's very important to sort of make sure that you're all aligned with, for example, if the patient has brain mets, are you going to start with systemic therapy? Or are you going to lean on radiation first? If the patient has, a big lung or mediastinal mass that's really threatening the thoracic structures, is your radiation oncologist going to treat first, or are you? There's quite a bit of things that need to be discussed. And of course, you brought up palliative care, which is super important in these patients who ultimately have a high disease burden and a high symptom burden in general. So getting them involved in the outset is also about the severity of disease, but really it's about the severity of the symptoms in terms of the dyspnea and fatigue that people can feel really just because the disease unfolds quite rapidly. And, we often hear the story that they were totally normal 2 months ago, or, they felt fine, and this has really unfolded over a matter of weeks. And so it all requires a similarly rapid response from the team that's taking care of them. I do think the medical oncologist ends up sort of being the quarterback. We're often the quarterback for many patients' plans, but I think for small cell lung cancer, that's sort of a key role because we know that we'll always be involved. Systemic therapy is always involved for small cell lung cancer. So in order to coordinate with the pulmonologist, radiation oncologist, palliative care, it's really our job.
How do oncology pharmacists and infusion or supportive care teams influence treatment delivery in small cell lung cancer, particularly when it comes to toxicity management, dose modifications, growth factor use, and patient education? And what do you wish more clinics implemented from a systems perspective?
Oncology pharmacists are superstars, and I have to say I'm so grateful to be able to have worked with excellent oncology pharmacists at many of the institutions where I've trained and worked. I think that they really are a key part in terms of rolling out not even new therapies, basically all therapies, because they're key players in involving the treatment plan and sort of the order set that comes along with the supportive measures, including antiemetics and growth factors. For something like tarlatamab, it's quite clear that their role is very significant in terms of how to manage key toxicities like CRS, and when to hold, what to give, when to give steroids, when to give tocilizumab, things like that are very important to have guidelines and to have everybody clear on what the management protocol should be, especially, in good communication where if you're admitting to a hospital, making sure the inpatient hospital team is aware of the guidelines, has had some sort of in-service training, hopefully led by a pharmacist that can sort of really give key guidance there. But in general, even outside of, the implementation of tarlatamab, I think many of these therapies for small cell lung cancer are kind of as tough as the cancer is. They're quite tough drugs to tolerate sometimes. And so optimizing antiemetics, growth factors, steroids, plans for diarrhea or nausea are so important because it helps keep patients on schedule and helps get them the therapy that they need to get. Having clear dose modification guidelines instead of just potentially skipping doses, of course, always hold when the patient needs it, but if we could find a way to continue to try to keep the patient on treatment as much as possible, I think that's better for a disease like small cell lung cancer. I do think toxicity algorithms, especially for sort of like after hours or triage, are really important. So if you have somebody answering the phones at your center, like a nursing pool or even potentially fellows who are training, having clear guidelines for what they're supposed to recommend after a drug like tarlatamab. What do you do if it's day five and they have a fever at home? Like, what are you supposed to counsel? What are you supposed to tell them to do? What are the ED precautions for a new drug like that? It's really important to have everybody on board with what you think the guidance should be. And I'm not saying there's one right answer, there's certainly not. But I think whatever internally you've all decided as the policy to follow is super important. And then the chemo teach, I'm not sure all institutions rely on this, but I do think it's a key part of delivering chemotherapy or other cancer drugs. We call it the chemo teach, but it really can be any anti-cancer therapy teach where somebody, whether it's a pharmacist or nurse practitioner or nurse, usually the oncologist may not have the time needed to spend like a full 30 or 45 minute appointment with the patient. It's sort of a separate appointment where they get full teaching on the drug and how to manage the side effects at home, when to call for help and where to call for help, what's an emergency and when can you just page the office, et cetera. It's really important and it helps people feel more prepared, helps people feel more empowered and in charge of their healthcare, and I think is a key part of delivering any of these medications.
Bringing it full circle, in the beginning, we talked about how relapsed small cell lung cancer remains one of the biggest challenges in thoracic oncology. When a patient does progress after frontline chemo IO, what does your real world approach look like? And what do you see as the most urgent unmet need in the community setting?
I think one of the issues in the community setting that is key that I've seen as someone who's worked at more tertiary academic centers is that there's a necessary lapse in time where if you want to get your patient to the next line best therapy, whether that's tarlatamab and your center can't deliver it, or a clinical trial, which we have so many promising clinical trials for small cell lung cancer right now. Like, it's an embarrassment of riches, honestly, of how many trials are ongoing, especially in the relapse setting, but also in the first line and maintenance setting. The gap of having to establish with a new provider, so get in the door with a new appointment for someone at an academic center, and then, that person to review their chart and sort of understand where they might be a fit, and then be able to deliver that next line of therapy, that's a potentially a several week delay in care. I'm not sure what the best way to remedy it is, except for at prior places where I've worked, I had a really good personal relationship with many of the physicians in the community where we'd email, text, and call about mutual patients all the time. And we'd sort of set up that pipeline of like, hey, I have this patient who has small cell lung cancer. Can I let you know when they're ready for something next? And then that way I can just sort of like make a spot in my schedule and see them right away. Oftentimes, if I know about a patient with small cell lung cancer, I will see them out of template. I will make a spot. I will stay, like we want to see these patients so quickly. But oftentimes, the physicians aren't looped into these requests or these referrals until way later. And so it may seem like there's a perceived sort of like backlog or pushback about how to get patients into these institutions. But I would say if you're able to just reach out, like I would do everything in my power to move my schedule around to get that patient in. So that is a huge thing. It's not really a systems thing that we can really fix, but it's sort of a way to work around the system to make sure that patients can ultimately get what they need. As someone who works at an academic center, I do still hopefully rely on these novel therapies as easily as hopefully as best I can. Oftentimes, there are patients who, on a personal level, do not want to undergo the operational constraints of something like tarlatamab. They say, you will never hospitalize me. I decline to do that. And that is totally fair. And that's their decision. In that scenario, I do lean on, for example, lurbinectedin in the second line setting quite frequently. One thing we haven't brought up yet is the IMforte trial, which approved the lurbinectedin and atezolizumab maintenance after the completion of induction chemoimmunotherapy. I have to say, I think it's good to know it's an option. I have not frequently employed that for patients that I see. I've used it once. I do think it's a rare patient that's able to tolerate more cytotoxic therapy directly after finishing induction chemotherapy. So that's another sort of thing where I think, the guidelines are there and that's an available therapy. It was actually just approved in October 2025, but I'm not sure it's very applicable to many of our patients who may be too fatigued and have too many adverse events after initial chemoimmunotherapy. I think I would just say for, ways we can improve moving forward, especially with the sort of community and academic gap, is as best we can to kind of be communicating with each other. I would love to see patients earlier. It's great when you send a patient if even if they don't need to be quote unquote named yet, because in that way they're established and they can sort of get what they need. I almost wish that there was some sort of service where we could match a patient with their eligibility trial criteria. Like, could we look at their labs and meds and scans sort of remotely without even having to see the patient? I think that's probably not super possible yet, but if there's something like a service, like a nurse navigator that could, potentially facilitate that, I think that would be a huge service so that we could sort of not waste anyone's time. The last thing we want to do is see a patient and waste their time if they're not eligible for any trials. I think that the future is bright for small cell lung cancer. There's so much going on and so much more work to be done. And it's a good time to be in this field because we really hope that the future continues to look bright.
Are you finding that these novel agents are as effective in your day-to-day?
It's a really good question and a really important question because I think oftentimes when novel therapies are approved, we have a tendency to sort of indiscriminately apply them to many patients who would not have been studied in the clinical trial. And so we don't have a full, complete, or comprehensive understanding both of the safety and efficacy, in that patient population. There have been several small real-world studies, that have been published looking at safety and efficacy. We also have been working on a larger cohort between a few institutions, correlating and coordinating these data. I think what's clear is that we are giving for example, tarlatamab to many patients with, for example, lower performance status than would have been allowed in the trials, patients with untreated brain mets, patients with significant medical comorbidities that would not have been allowed on trial. So we are really kind of giving this across the board. And these patients may have a tendency towards potentially higher toxicity. A few studies have shown that the incidence of ICANS is potentially more common, although it's hard to know if that is something to do with the patient population or something to do with the grading of ICANS in the real world, where I think it's a really challenging diagnosis. And in clinical trials, they're much stricter about calling something ICANS than potentially real-world cohorts might have just called it ICANS. So that's sort of a conflated or confounded toxicity parameter, but I think many reports have shown that. But the other thing that I think is probably true is that there seems to be probably lower efficacy in patients who would not have been eligible for the clinical trial. So for patients who are less fit, for patients who have, significant medical comorbidities, may have a tendency more towards, developing progressive disease or to less durable responses. And so something to kind of temper your own thoughts on when you're thinking about options for a patient. Tarlatamab has been a really exciting and promising therapy for many patients, but not for all patients. And I think it's really key that we continue to try to understand safety risk algorithms, what are the risk factors to developing CRS and ICANS, as well as efficacy predictors, which I think is a nascent and still developing field.
So then when it comes to the clinical trials that are available for patients and the embarrassment of riches that you alluded to earlier, what targets have piqued your interest and why?
Sure, that's a great question. Obviously, starting out with DLL3, which I think everybody knows about because the advent of tarlatamab, but there are plenty of other therapies targeting DLL3 that are under investigation. Golcadomig is a DLL3 targeting trispecific T cell engager, so has a different binding moiety in addition to the two that are seen in tarlatamab. There's the obrixtamig is BI's DLL3 targeting T cell engager. There are also DLL3 targeting antibody drug conjugates. There's at least a couple which are under investigation and look really promising, and actually might be a really interesting avenue to explore at least sequencing in this area because, similar target if the target is preserved, but a different mechanism of action that might be a really exciting way to potentially allow for these patients to get more therapies if one is sort of not as effective as you hoped. Those are just some of the DLL3 targeting agents out there. One of the really exciting targets has been SEZ6. This is a highly expressed marker in neuroendocrine malignancies, including small cell lung cancer. And a SEZ6 targeting antibody drug conjugate by AbbVie has been shown to be really an exciting and promising new drug. The findings were presented at World Lung by Lauren Byers of MD Anderson and it showed a really exciting response rate. And there will be some trials of this drug in the first and later line settings. I think really something to keep in mind and look out for in the future. And then, of course, I think everybody also knows about the target B7-H3, for which there is a B7-H3 targeting ADC, ifinatamab deruxtecan, that has been published as a good agent in the relapsed refractory setting as well. That publication and presentation by Charlie Rudin at Sloan Kettering. And that is also something good to reach for as well. I think, one of the big issues with these newly discovered targets and agents is there are a few. One is how predictive are these biomarkers in terms of response and resistance? So if patients' tumor tissue expresses these antigens, does that mean that these therapies will be effective? I actually think we don't know the answer to that yet. It would seem sort of logical that those things would follow, but we actually, I don't think, truly know the answer in terms of predictive efficacy there. And then in terms of sequencing, what kinds of upregulation and downregulation are there of these targets, specifically after, for example, chemoimmunotherapy? Would there be a change on treatment naive biopsies versus resistance biopsies? That would be super important to know. Other important thing is in terms of sequencing, one of the major things about small cell lung cancer, which I don't think that I've specifically elucidated yet, is that many, many patients don't make it to second or third or fourth line therapy. And so you kind of are hoping that you can pick your best therapy as early as possible. And so knowing which of these therapies would be most promising for your patient is a huge unmet need and area of active investigation right now. But I think one thing that's sort of emerging is whether for ADC specifically, we think probably that the payload confers more resistance than, for example, the target. So if you had, for example, a topoisomerase 1 inhibiting payload prior, maybe you shouldn't give another drug that does the same thing, even if it has a different antibody target. So again, that's all developing and new. We're not totally sure where all of that's going to go. But for the few patients, and there are some patients, I've had many patients actually who have gotten 3, 4, or 5 lines of therapy, will be really important to understand what is the one they should receive first and then next and then next, and how can we enhance efficacy and reduce toxicity by employing sequencing strategies.
Thank you so much for joining me on today's podcast.
Thank you for having me.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.